This episode of Standard Orbit is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program for the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. Want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
This is Walter Koenig, Chekhov from Star Trek, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Risk is our business.
It's like nothing we've dealt with before.
By golly, Jim, I'm beginning to think I can cure a rainy day.
I can't change the laws of physics.
Now in standard orbit, sir.
Welcome, everyone, to Standard Orbit, Trek FM's dedicated podcast that covers the original and new cast of Captain Kirk in the Enterprise. I am Ken Tripp.
And I am Zach Moore, and we are back for part two of our conversation with John Tenuto about the Wrath of Khan on VHS, all things Star Trek home video, past, present, and future. So let's just jump right back into it. Energize.
There's sort of one of the things that's out there that, you know, I never say that it's absolutely wrong or is wrong or, yeah, because who knows. But, you know, Wrath of Khan, we have a lot of the memos from Wrath of Khan and its production. And in those memos, it was meant to be a TV movie of the week. And it was budgeted as a TV movie of the week. And there's some people who say, no, it was produced by the TV side. That everybody agrees with that. That's a fact, right? But that it was never meant to be a TV movie of the week. Well, you know, we have the budgets that show them actually doing, like, well, if we switch to a 35 millimeter or if we switch to a movie, it's going to be this amount of money. And there's, to me, that it started off as like what was meant to be a 2-hour movie of the week. And then now when Meyer is participating in it, by that time, it's only a movie. You know, he's not participating in it when it was in those stages, when it was a TV movie. But that it started off as, you know, an hour and a half TV movie of the week to be probably, you know, kind of forgotten except by Star Trek fans, and then turned into the biggest opening film of all time, to me, is a phenomenal story.
I remember it well. I certainly do. And then E.T. came along that same year.
And, mm-hmm. and then decimated it, right?
I remember just like the following week, because you're competitive, right, when you're a Star Trek fan. And E.T. was obviously a brilliant movie, but it was just funny that I just remember them being at the cinemas together. You know, back in the day, Zach, as I sit here in my rocking chair. But so, John, I know we're running on close on time here. I wanted to just... A question I really wanted to ask you because, and I think I know the answer to this, but I'd never assume, you know, I saw a lot of polls and things that came out right after Discovery about, you know, was Discovery the best first season of Star Trek ever? And of course, my bias is so towards TOS for all the right reasons, I think. Mm-hmm. I was curious your thoughts on that because, man, I haven't seen, I love all the Star Trek incarnations to a certain level, some better than others, but I just don't know if it cleared that bar. What are your thoughts there?
Well, you know, I always think of Star Trek, to me, Star Trek's like pizza, right? And there's no such thing as bad pizza, but there are pizzas that are better than other pizzas. And so I'll take a bad episode of Star Trek any day, because it's probably better than the best episodes of a lot of other shows, you know? But I think, you know, this is just my reaction as a fan, my honest reaction to Discovery. There is a lot to admire, I think, with Discovery. There's also a lot that I, just speaking as myself, not even as a sociologist or anything, just as a fan, mm-hmm. I'm a little troubled by the amount of violence. I'm a little troubled by the, it seemed like it was a little lost to me. And I think part of that is just the fact of how it was created. There was a situation that occurred in the middle of its creation, and the show became something different, and they probably did the best that they could under the time constraints that they had. And there were moments of it that were beautiful, and there were characters that I cared for. I really like Stamets, because I think I like him so much. And I think my wife and son agree, because he's probably the most traditional Star Trek. He's the most recognizable Star Trek character to me on the show. When I look at the show and I say, well, who could you pick up and move to? I think it would be Saru and Stamets. You could kind of pick them up and flop them into Next Gen and they'd be okay.
Yeah.
I don't know that that's true of a lot of the other characters, at least not yet. And so I think there's a lot to admire about Discovery. I liked it. I was always excited to see what was going to happen next. I was a little disappointed in the lack of exploration that was done in that season. I mean, they only went to like five planets, and for some of them, they weren't even on them very long. It missed some of what I thought made Star Trek Star Trek, which is the exploration and not just exploring relationships, which is part of Star Trek, but also exploring really big ideas and exploring other races as a metaphor for something. So I just kind of felt like I had been promised that I was really going to get to know the Klingons, and I don't really feel that I got to know the Klingons very much. And just things like that. And so, I would not call it the best season of first season of Star Trek. I think, every season, every Star Trek has growing pains. I was very... I was hopeful in the last few episodes of Discovery. It sort of felt like, oh yeah, this is, and I don't mean to say it has to be familiar, because I don't want the same thing again. If I want the same thing, I can go back and watch TOS. I can go back and watch Next Gen. I don't mind different. But I do think my hope, and this is a separate issue, I guess, but my hope is that this arc-based TV trend will end at some point, because I do think there's a value to, I'm sort of season arc based storytelling. I think there's a value to micro arc based storytelling, and I think there's a value to episodic television. Mm-hmm. And I think and I don't know that this seasonal arc thing can necessarily, it can be pulled off, but what happens is then the next season becomes something so different that a lot of times shows move characters fundamentally from who they were the prior season. I'm thinking of shows like Arrow or Flash, where it's the second season is unrecognizable to the first season, even if they're the same people, because the situation starts to dictate. So, what's the difference? The difference is in the original Star Trek, Captain Kirk was a fairly static character across the 79 episodes, but that's what made it interesting, because you got to see how that static character reacted to a bunch of different scenarios. Now what you have is the scenario stays the same for a season and the character changes. Mm-hmm. And that's harder, I think, for me to have, it's harder for me to root for somebody because I don't really know who they are.
No, that's an excellent point. I feel like, it shows I'd say Deep Space Nine or The X-Files or even, Battlestar Galactica kind of found a nice middle ground to that. Mm-hmm. But we're falling into a trap now where it's like you can't – the thing about Star Trek, right, is you could take one episode, 1 hour, 45 minutes, right, a nice self-contained story with just very fulfilling beginning, middle, and end. But now you cannot, go back and watch one random episode of, Lost or Heroes or something.
Yeah, absolutely.
Chapter 17 of 400. It's it's not very fulfilling. So, yeah, that middle ground, I think we need to pull back. I am right there with you, John. That's a great point.
So I think the fan reaction, not that I would ever want to speak for other fans, but there isn't – I do this too. When you see something new that you've been waiting for a long time, there's a tendency to elevate it, because you're having an emotional reaction to it right away, which is usually love. I mean, it's sort of like, wow, is that, yes, And so, I always try to scale back and say, well, was Last Jedi as good as Empire Strikes Back? I need a little time to kind of think about that. I think all fans, we all have that experience. I think all of us where mm-hmm. we kind of come to something and we might have a really passionate either dislike for it or like for it right away. And then you sit with it for a while and you might reevaluate it or you might revisit it and you might change your opinion. And I think, I think that may occur with Discovery, where people are going to say, I mean, maybe I'm wrong. People may, they are, and it's okay. It's really great. I'm so happy if somebody comes to Star Trek through Discovery and that's their introduction. And so for them, of course, for somebody who their first introduction is to whatever it's usually your first James Bond that you love the best. It's your first Superman that you love the best. And so, of course, that makes total sense to that someone would love that. For me, I would say it was the most unusual season of Star Trek. I would say it was the most eventful. In other words, it was the most where every week it was like an event episode, you know? But at some point, you have to stop where every week there's a surprise, I think. And I think some of that was the show trying to put itself, I don't want to say right, but I read Michael Burnham's speech in the last episode. Some people are going to probably hate me. I read it as an apology. Like, what you saw the last 15 episodes was Lorca land, right? And that's not what we are as Starfleet. What we are as Starfleet is these really good things. And guess what? From now until the end of the show, that's what we're going to be. That's how I read that speech she was making to the Starfleet brass at the end when she got her mm-hmm. award. I could be wrong, but that's kind of how I read it, and that's why I'm very hopeful that we're going to get a more exploration, and maybe that middle ground where instead of doing a season long arc, they're going to do. Because I think Enterprise had a great idea. You know, they were just sort of trying, getting that feeling in the fourth season of like, yeah, do 3-episode mini arcs, you know, and then have those have consequences later. That's okay. You know, keep it realistic. And I hope that they adopt that I would love to see that. I would really love for them to move away from where, you know, I mean, I get it. I get that, like, if this was the original Star Trek, these 15 hours would have happened in one episode, right? Spock mutinies but that is part of the problem with modern television, because that story kind of could have been told in a couple of episodes, those 15 hours. We didn't need all that time. It's sort of what happens with comic books today, right? When you read they're like 6 issues, that would have been like the first 8 pages in, you know, a comic from the 1960s or something, where it's sort of like the storytelling gets dragged out because they have to have it be a season long. And then what you have is adjustments made because of that to the story. And I just think that's a mistake from kind of a creative point of view.
Well, we'll have to talk comic books sometime, John. I'm a huge Arrow, Flash comic book guy myself, so interesting to know you are as well. So.
I it isn't that I don't enjoy the new ones or anything like that. I mean, I'm very excited. I would love to see I would love to see a show called Star Trek Stamets, you know, or Star Trek Saru. I hope they get elevated in the second season a little bit more. But it is strange. Like, it's like, I don't know the bridge crew, you know, I don't really, they have no personalities yet. Mm. And we didn't get a chance because we spent so much time with characters. Like, will Lorca matter anymore? So, I mean, we spent so much time with him and will he matter? I mean, he may matter in a symbolic way on the show, but like,
well, it'll be just like, well, you mentioned The Flash. It'll be just like Harrison Wells, season one of The Flash. If we do get Prime Lorca, he'll be like, you know, Earth 2 Harrison Wells, right? And it's like, well, that's not the same guy that I loved in the first season. So, yeah, that's the danger. That's a great breakdown of television today. I didn't expect that, John. This is a great tangent. I mean, we love tangents here on Standard Orbit. That is an excellent.
Oh, yeah. That was awesome. Hey, you know, we haven't, you know, you've been on Standard Orbit before. You've never been on with us. And so, you know, we were taking, I took a liberty there to change course a little bit, just because this is probably the most fresh Star Trek thing and really just wanted to get your feel on it. So I do appreciate it and really do appreciate all the great information you provided. This,
it's one thing to listen to podcasts all the time, which we do, Zach and I and the rest of us, and we've listened to you many times, especially in the other Standard Orbit, or I should say version one. What are we, 3.0? 3.0.
Something like that. Really,
yeah, who knows?
Really Enterprise A, I think.
Yeah. Something like that, yeah. And I even posted up when Star Trek II was released again back in September. That show you did on Standard Orbit, and just, you know, with Mike Schindler and Drew, and they got some nice hits even back then. It was such a great history lesson. And I'm going to see Star Trek II in the theater with William Shatner up in Concord, New Hampshire on May
6th. Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, so, how great. Oh, my gosh.
I do kind of laugh, though, because he's going to be doing Q&A afterwards, and it's like, he doesn't remember anything.
They need Scott Mann's too. Well, I loved when they showed it, and they showed it in the theaters. Was about was that a year ago? Not even really. About
September.
I have 6 months. Ago. Yeah.
Yeah, September. Yeah.
And I thought Scott had did a great job, kind of guiding, because it is, you know, and Bill starts to tell a story from Star Trek III, you know, and he kind of guides him back or whatever. But you know, I always think, you know, it is like. Yeah, I kind of get that. Like, I always say, like, I would hate to, like, watch me teach. You know what I mean? Like, I would be bored because I did it, you know. And that's probably true of all of us in our occupation. Like, who would want to watch themselves work, you know? And then you move on to the next thing or whatever. But I really think, this is just a pitch, right? I really think Wrath of Khan needs a proper making of book. Now, Alan Asherman did a book that was really great back in the day when the film came out, but it was more like a, it was an official studio, you know, so it was kind of like interviews with people. And I really would, and then, you know, we have Nicholas Meyer, he has a chapter in his book about Wrath of Khan, but I think Wrath of Khan, and frankly, I think a lot of the Star Trek films, but particularly Wrath of Khan, that deserves the two books I'd love to see the most. I want to see a Star Trek Beyond novel, just because it irks me that I don't have one, and I have one for every other Star Trek film. And Beyond, I think, really deserves it, because I think there's great backstory that we could learn. I don't know if
we're that goes back to what you were talking about, home video being prevalent, like novelizations were a huge part of you not being able to revisit the film at home. So you had the novel. And so now we've gotten to the point where, oh, I guess we don't need those anymore. Where is Alan Dean Foster when you need him? Just give him a call. I'm sure he'll
absolutely
write
it,
right?
Oh, no kidding. Yeah. I mean, if I was super rich, I'd just pay somebody to write the Star Trek. I'd ask Alan Dean Foster, could you please write Star Trek Beyond just for me? But I think Star Wars has a good model, right? I mean, I just started reading the Last Jedi novel, and I thought, well, you know, this is interesting. It's got input from the director. It's got not only the deleted scenes in the book, but it takes scenes that the director kind of wanted to do but couldn't. Wow. So I don't want to give anything away to anybody who hasn't read the book. So, but I'm like maybe 50 pages in, and I'm starting to get into the kind of where the story kind of begins, you know, and in terms of the film. And I've really loved this additional stuff, because it isn't just, you know, it isn't just sort of like, well, the mind of the one author and they're padding, you know, or doing something like that. It's really genuinely expanded, you know, interesting stuff. And knowing it's a Star Wars book, therefore it's canon. So what's in there has legitimacy. And I think that might be an interesting model for Star Trek books, because I know Star Trek Beyond had very different iterations, and even its final version, there were changes that were made in terms
of Admiral Paris was added in reshoots as a character.
I would love to see kind of where the story was originally going to go with like a making of, and I'd also love to see a novelization. But I think Star Trek II really needs, a making of book, and you know, I'd love to have, I mean, if Nicholas Meyer could write it, I mean, just really write a deep, yeah, be fantastic. Or have somebody who, you know, who worked on it and who has a kind of an overview of it. But I think that's also one of the things that's been lost a little bit with DVDs too, right? I mean, we don't get as many kind of making of things for Star Trek where we used to. There was a making of Insurrection. There was a, you know, there were making of books for some of the other Star Trek films. And there was one for Star Trek V. And you know, that's kind of the weird, the interesting thing about Star Trek is the, it's always the, it's like the film, it's like the alternate film that gets something. So one had a making of book, three had a making of book, you know, two did too, but you know, four didn't, you know, six kind of had one, but it wasn't, I don't think it was official. You know, I mean, there's just, there's so many great stories to tell. I wish that they could, they would go back and tell it from, and clear up some of the mythology about the movies, because there is a lot of mythology and there's a lot of people who believe this and it really, it didn't happen that way, you know.
Well, you know, I'll say one thing though about, you talk about making of and so forth, just to pull it back to Star Trek II, it is still the best movie commentary of any movie I have ever seen.
Listening
to Nicholas Meyer walk through that film, the things he talks about, the things he makes you think about, the direction he goes when he's just talking about art in general and the way he puts things together. There are quotes from that commentary that I have adapted in the business world and use all the time. It is my favorite by far. I'll watch that movie with the commentary and prefer that sometimes over than just watching the movie. It is that good.
Yeah, he is, you know, what I love is like, what one of the things that we wanted to do with one of the talks that we gave is kind of a celebration of the behind the scenes people, which is really what all of the research that my wife and I do into Star Trek is about. And a lot of the articles we write for StarTrek.com are about, although we're doing one that's going to be fun coming up about game shows, Star Trek and game shows. But so sometimes we want to do something fun, but a lot of times it's celebrating the names. We always want, you know, our biggest joy would be for someone to watch the credits of Star Trek II and go, I can put a face to that. I know that what that person looks like. I know what their contribution was. And so it's not just Gayn Resher's name going by, you know, it's the people know who he was and what he did for the film. And that was one of the great things about that commentary, because he talked about this is the collaborative nature of that film and the contributions people made. So one of the times we communicated with him, we wanted to know about costumes, because we wanted to talk about Robert Fletcher's contributions to the costume design. And funny, he gave us a great line, which we use in the talk, which is his wife said about the costumes that they were nautical but nice, which I thought was instead of naughty but nice, but I thought that was a great line. But that they were really meant to be a reflection of the Prisoner of Zenda. So I'm like, oh, okay. So I need to go back and look at this. So we, my wife and I go back and we watch Prisoner of Zenda and like, oh my God. I mean, they are the Star Trek II costumes by inspiration. Absolutely. I mean, they're red and the you have the thing that comes down where the flap that comes down. I mean, but he gave us so much more than that. He talked about how costume is character. And because I had told him I love the moment when McCoy in Star Trek VI, he's drunk, he's exasperated. They've had that horrible dinner with the Klingons. It hasn't gone well. And he just rips open his collar, you know, boom, and just the flap comes down. And he says, oh yeah, I mean, that's, you have to use costume. So then he starts teaching me in the email about Lawrence of Arabia and costume. And I think he thinks in film history, like he can be conversant in the popular culture side of it and do like one of my favorite things he ever wrote was the liner notes to John Williams' Star Wars soundtrack, which is just insane, right? Like, why is Nicholas Meyer writing this Star Wars commentary? And it's brilliant, you know, it gives me a whole new appreciation of it. And anything like that where you can listen to it and get an appreciation for why people did what he did. You know, the other thing I like about him real fast too is he doesn't tell you how you're supposed to interpret the scene. And I love that. That's the one, like if I asked him like, why did you do this? You know, or why is Khan got one glove or something? You're not going to get an answer.
Until we get the series, we're going to get the answer, right, John?
Well, that would be great. Yeah.
He's going to completely undercut what he said for 30 years when he gives us that answer.
They're going to call it the glove of Khan. That's the name of the show.
Yes.
That'd be brilliant.
Well, you know, to wrap things up, one last question I wanted to ask you about Star Trek II was, you know, ABC had his expanded version, you know, on the mm-hmm. air in the 80s. And then that's the one a lot of people, you know, got used to watching. If people hadn't caught, you know, in the theater, that's the one they had seen. And then you get this VHS tape and it's missing scenes, you know? Mm-hmm. Is there any kind of buzz about that when that came out? Or people like, hey, what happened to these scenes? Or do people just not remember it that much to even notice it?
Well, you know what's, the funniest thing is how many people have kind of false memories about sequences. So, and part of it is because of imagery that gets released, you know, or key art that gets released. So, for example, on the Star Trek II movie poster, the one that is the original one where you kind of have different images almost mm-hmm. in like rectangles around a picture. There's an image of David and Kirk, and David's kind of above Kirk with a knife, but they're laying on the ground.
Yeah, you know, I remember that. Yeah,
with one another. And so that's because it was filmed like that. The original fight sequence between the two of them, and we have the images of that fight, was much longer. And there is a moment where Kirk actually pulls, you know, he thinks he can get an advantage on David, who's younger, right, by pulling him down onto the ground in an unexpected maneuver. And David winds up getting the best of Kirk. And actually, David has Kirk under his knife, literally, until the mother walks in. And in the movie, it's just a much quicker little like boom, 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 and it's over. There's no like really big giant fight scene there between the two of them. But because that image stays there, people will say, you know, well, but I saw that scene, you know, it was in the original release, or I saw it on the ABC TV version. I saw mm-hmm. that fight scene, and that fight scene was never assembled as a deleted. It was never assembled as a scene. They did the stunt work on it. And they did the blocking for it, but to my knowledge, they never actually filmed it. It was only filmed by set photographer. And if they filmed it, it's never surfaced, right? Which is possible. They may have filmed it, but and they did film, for example, there was sort of half the Khan baby, half the stuff was filmed, and half wasn't filmed because it just didn't work out with the kid itself. But I have the audio of the Khan baby scene with Terrell and Chekhov and them seeing the kid outside the window, and there's a crib in the thing. And a lot of people say, well, they've seen that, but they haven't seen it because what they did was they read the novel, and it's in the novel. So that's always, I think, a fascinating experience is kind of how we remember stuff, or maybe putting together things from a bunch of years ago when we first saw it or were first introduced to it, or when you see the ABC version and they're in the elevator, the editing is different on the two of them, you know, on Kirk and Savick. The way that it's cut is different. The close-ups are different in the TV version than in the theatrical version, and which is more of like a two-shot for the most part. They don't do kind of too many close-ups with each other in the original theatrical version. And then you get this different version. And I always like that one because I like the close-ups, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting that you can see people have edited these together for comparison, like on YouTube, if you go search for them. It's interesting, you know, a little minor, like the minorist, is that the term? But the minorist change.
You're scaring me.
But yeah, because it's just the edit. It's same thing with like Star Trek VI, you know, look at the director's cut of that, like little just frames here and there. Like, why would they make these changes? It's so odd. But I'm curious, like if people felt gypped when they got the VHS tape, and they're like, wait, you know, I know I have these scenes, like where's Scotty's nephew? Like I know that Scotty's nephew died and they had a whole scene about it. And yet it's not in my VHS tape here. I'm sure that drove some people crazy, and people all thought like, oh no, you just imagine that. It's like, no, I saw these scenes on ABC. And then finally when the DVDs come out, you know, in the early 2000s, they feel vindicated because see, these were here all along. I wasn't crazy.
Yeah, and you know, it's just kind of which version did you see it in? And I remember once having a chat with a fellow fan at a convention after my wife and I had done a Making of Star Trek VI talk, and he would have laid money that he saw the Colonel West, you know, flip the papers over, you know, let's go in and get this guy, you know, when you got Renee Bergeron playing that character, that he saw that in the theater in the in the initial release. And it was like, no, you know, you saw that on home video, you know, and it's hard because our memories are so specific. Like I could swear, that's how I remember it, you know, it is tough, and if you're expecting one thing, and when you get the videotape and it's not on there, you're like, why did they re-edit this thing? But they didn't. They're showing you the way it really originally right. was, you know?
Yeah, no,
go ahead. I was just going to say, I love, like, they just released the 3-hour TV version of Superman.
That is exactly right? what I was going to say. Yeah. Yeah, no, for real. Yeah, the 3-hour Superman cut.
Oh.
It was a revelation to me.
I have such great memories of that. I was a kid. I was very angry because my parents. Well, I had a confirmation. I believe I was confirmed the day that it was on, and then my parents had this party for me. And I remember being mad at them because I was like, "Remember, you know, again, this is the era. No VH. I didn't have a VHS player, right? So it's like 1980, whenever that was on TV." And I was mad because I wanted to see Superman because there were extended scenes. Like there was scenes that I never saw in the theater. And that was the first time I was ever introduced to that concept that there were scenes that you never saw before, you know, that they edit scenes out of films. I never really thought of that too much until Star Wars and the whole Biggs and Jabba and the comic book difference and Superman. Those were my two sort of introductions to that idea, and that they'd re-released it now. I just, oh my gosh, and it's so great because you hear like
it's amazing.
Yeah, and then you've got Jeff East, who plays Clark in the Smallville scenes, which are some of my favorites. You hear his own voice in some of the scenes because they never dubbed it over because they were not going to include that in the theatrical version. Mm-hmm. I just love that. I mean, to me, it's like it's almost like I felt like watching when I was watching Donner's Superman. I mean, it was like an alternate universe. Like, what planet am I on? And it felt like a whole new Superman film with Christopher Reeve. It was a gift, you know, a beautiful thing. So
it's funny, both our minds went there.
I mean, there is footage from Wrath of Khan that people have never seen that's in the original edit, the sort of first edit of the film, that's never been released either on YouTube or on the Blu-rays or anything like that. And I would love for them to do what they did with Star Trek, with Superman, and give us
every last scrap of footage in there.
Yeah. 3 hours and just be like, here you go. And here it is. And, you know, yes, the pacing isn't great. I mean, cause really the 3-hour Superman film, there is some things where the pacing is just like,
All the stuff with Lex in the middle with the car, it just goes on and on.
Yeah. It's just incredible. But I'm okay with that because I want to see that, you know?
Oh yeah, so yeah, the stuff with like Savick being Romulan, and I think there's like an alternate ending with like her and David making eyes at each other on the bridge. Like I've seen clips of that, like in, I don't know where it came from, but I've seen it on YouTube. I've never seen it in any official release. So there's it's
yeah,
good.
And they
it's
and
good
they,
to know
they did
some stuff out there to be discovered. So.
Yeah, they did film the Terrell Chekhov Khan baby scene that was filmed. There is a moment where Savick and David are on when they're in the sort of Genesis cave, when they're having the fruit and they're in the nice part of the cave, where they have a conversation about him being a bastard, you know, and a bastard child, and use those words. And Chekhov is in that scene. That's like, to me, one of the, like, interesting things. So there's a moment where McCoy actually walks over and checks on Chekhov. And I always thought like that was, did they leave poor Chekhov like in the back room, like by himself but they didn't, he's there. But the way that they film it and the way that we've all seen it, you don't see him, but he is there off to Kirk's side. And they just framed him kind of out and focused more on Kirk and that, but there's a whole bunch of stuff just within the Genesis cave that was filmed that I would love to see, you know, and I hope someday that surfaces, and even if they don't upvert it, just to be able to see it on something would be great.
Oh, of course. Yeah. It's a revelation to even get an amazing gift to get the Superman footage we have in HD. That blew me away. But yeah, I totally go with the 4x3 standard definition, grainy, just let's just see it to see it. Right.
Yeah. give it to me on a flip book as long as I get to see the thing, you know.
Great. Well, John, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us, man. This has been an amazing conversation and a great
incredible
thing. Yeah, thanks guys, I really appreciate it, and I hope that you know, I'm really glad that Star Trek is back. I'm glad Discovery's back. I hope that we get just more and more and more Star Trek. I think you know, I Star Trek belongs in a weekly format, you know, as much as I love the films, and I hope that we get more and more, and then we just get more and more to research and talk about. And it's just, it's a great time to be a Star Trek fan. That's for sure.
It certainly is. And I hope they bring the movies back too. I hope it just keeps coming.
I do. I'm hoping for, I'd love to see a fourth adventure. I loved Beyond. I thought it was a beautiful film, and
it was awesome.
It just, it was really, you know, so much about it was fantastic, and I hope that crew can get back together again.
Absolutely. Well, John, if people want to find you out there on the internet, where can they find you?
Best place is on Twitter. If people would like to be great to get in contact, just at it's at Tenuto Family, and that's my wife and my account, and we do a lot of, you know, we let people know about articles there, and we also post little, you know, pictures of our collection and things like that. And we're not 100% sure, but, you know, I'm in an episode of the show, The Toys That Made Us, about Star Wars toys. And mm-hmm. there is an upcoming episode on Star Trek toys for everyone to look out for.
Yes, I'm looking up forward to that one very much so.
Yeah. And my wife and I participated in that as well. So hopefully people will be able to get to see a little bit of our collection. And it's a really wonderful history of the making of the Star Trek toys, and so that's another way people can kind of get some more of our research. And of course, StarTrek.com, we write articles, you know, one or two a month, and try to share some of the Star Trek history there as well.
All right, well, Star Trek 2 and videotapes and everything in between isn't the only thing we're talking about here on Trek FM this week. Here's a quick look at what else you might have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Primitive Culture, a look at history and culture through Star Trek.
You know, and I used to have a pretend phaser, and I used to, you know, I had a tricorder. I think I was a science officer in my head. I wasn't like Kirk or a Jedi running around saving the galaxy. I was, oh, look at that rock formation over there. Right? You know, so I think, which is ironic because I'm the least practical person in the real world, so I'd be useless on a science expedition. I'd be a red shirt. If I was in Star Trek, Clara, I'd be a red shirt. I'd be dead as soon as I got on that planet, right? That's the more realistic depiction of me in Star Trek universe, right? I'd be the guy killed by the hulking Gorn as soon as I beamed down. Oh, I see Crewman Black's dead. Yeah, shouldn't have brought him, really.
Earl Grey.
Whoa, you're telling me I can't do the thing that I always do that's bad? Like, I don't know about that. Like, that's a very universal thing when conservation, whatever, right? Although I wasn't the biggest fan of the execution and then them completely dropping ball with it or at least just sweeping it on the rug, I should say. They just decided, like, let's talk about it. I appreciate the fact they brought it up at all, honestly. Like, if that had been on TOS, to be honest, they would have never brought it up again, right?
Oh, yeah, gone.
Give us Warp 14 again.
Warp 5.
From Major Carpenter, which is why he calls himself Carpenter. And then he says his first name is John. Jesus Christ, John Carpenter, JCs. And John was a disciple.
His name is John Carpenter? Oh, yeah. My God. I never made that connection. Whoa.
But his previous...
He's made some really good movies.
Just jumped up a few pegs.
The Edge, a Star Trek Discovery podcast.
You're killing me. I'm going to pull my hair out if that happens, because I really do need to know.
What if, like, I just had a crazy idea. What if they get the captain in the first episode, but they continue on with these lower deck characters so well that we just never see the captain, and it's like the teacher in Charlie Brown, like...
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they are published. And please leave us a star rating and a written review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Speaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and most third-party apps, and you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link as well.
If you'd like to help us keep all our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Visit Patreon, that's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month, so we really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. We also want to thank very, very much our esteemed associate producers, Norman C. Lau, Nicholas Anastasio, Tim Robertson, Richard Marquez, Corey Elrod, and Dan Rhodes. So Norm, Nick, Tim, Richard, Corey, and Dan, thank you from the bottom of our hearts. It means as much as we can possibly tell you the world to us that you've agreed to sign on and help keep Standard Orbit alive and well.
Yes, thank you so much, guys. We really do appreciate all your contributions. So we'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are many ways for you to do that. The best place to join in the larger conversation is the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. If you'd like to send us email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose to send to a show and select Standard Orbit. That will come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter at TrekFM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. As for us personally, you can find me on Twitter at MoronZach. That's MoreOnZach. And I'm also the host of my own show called Always Hold On to Smallville, where we talk about each and every episode of that Young Superman show. You can find us on Twitter at AlwaysMallville with one S. What about you, Ken?
Well, you can find me on Twitter as well at Boston, SCPO, stands for at Boston Senior Chief Petty Officer. And I'm also on the Babel Conference whenever I can be, engaging and trying to add, you know, a lot of good provocative suggestions to our other shows. But anyway, we look forward to seeing you on the Babel Conference and responding back and forth on this show as well.
All right, well, that's going to do it for us this week. But stay tuned next time for another edition of Standard Orbit.